In this episode of Startups Are Us, I'm going to be talking to Cortland Allen from Indie Hackers about surprising discoveries that new founders learn. This is Startups Are Us, episode 357. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Cortland.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Cortland?
I'm doing excellent. A little bit sick, a little bit overworked, but other than that, doing great.
Well, it is Friday. For the listeners, it'll be Tuesday, but it is Friday for us. So hopefully you'll be better by the weekend.
You know, I'm getting into the habit of having weekends. It's usually every day is the same to me, but my girlfriend is helping me develop better and healthier work habits. So looking forward to the weekend as well.
Excellent. So I wanted to give you a brief introduction to you if the listeners aren't familiar with what you've done and what your background is. But you've run a popular community for aspiring entrepreneurs and founders called Indie Hackers, which is it has a series of interviews and blog posts and various articles on there that entrepreneurs and founders can learn from. And Indie Hackers was recently acquired by Stripe as well, right?
Yep. Been at Stripe for 5 months now.
Okay. How's that going? It's interesting to hear from somebody who is acquired by Stripe. I've talked to the guys at Stripe, and Patrick McKenzie, who's also a friend of the show and a frequent speaker at MicroConf, has kind of moved over to Stripe as well. But I'm interested to hear about like kind of the transition from like owning your own thing and going into Stripe.
Yeah, I have to say that Patrick, by the way, is great. I've gotten the chance to hang out with him at the Stripe HQ a couple times that he's been in the US, and he's been very helpful. But I always tell people at Stripe when they ask me how it's been, Stripe is my first full-time job. I'm 30 years old. I've always worked on startups and as an entrepreneur since I graduated college. In a lot of ways, I was worried before I joined that I wouldn't like it. But also, Patrick Collison has been so amazing. Like, the way that they handled the acquisition was exactly how you should handle acquisitions, in my opinion, which is to be as hands-off as possible. So my life actually hasn't changed very much since before joining Stripe, now that I'm at Stripe. And they've really, I mean, they've made things easier to run. Before I joined Stripe, I was basically financing Indie Hackers by selling advertising. So I had ads in the email newsletter, on the podcast, on the website itself. And that was starting to take up so much time. I mean, I got to about $5,000 a month in revenue by the time I was acquired, but I was beginning to spend like half of my time on ads. And so the most helpful thing that Stripe has done is just paid me a salary, so I don't have to worry about any of that. And I've been able to focus much more on the quality of the website itself and improving the community. So joining Stripe was a great decision, I think, and I'm excited to see where things go in the future.
Interestingly enough, there's a kind of a corollary there where 100% of your revenue probably came from those ads. So if you're spending 50% of your time on it, then you've got 50% of your time free to do whatever.
That's true.
So wanted to talk to you today just because you've got a lot of experience talking to various founders and entrepreneurs. Obviously, like you've got your own podcast that kind of goes along with Indie Hackers, where you interview founders and talk to them about what has gone into their business and what sorts of successes and failures they've had along the way. And I thought it'd be interesting to have you on to talk about some of the commonly held expectations that new founders have that don't necessarily hold up to reality. And obviously, like you're going to draw some of the various examples and stuff, but also from your own experience and background running Indie Hackers as well.
Yeah, totally. I think it's tricky being a startup founder, especially if it's your first time, because as a consumer, as a normal member of society, your view into what happens at any company is extremely limited. You generally see the information that they put out there that they want you to see, but you don't really see what goes on behind the scenes. And so when you start, I think you tend to be driven by your intuition and by what you've experienced as a consumer. But it turns out that actually being a founder and starting a company is completely different than it looks. And people end up falling into kind of the same holes, the same pitfalls, the same mistakes that others have fallen into simply because they don't know what to expect. So I think it's definitely worthwhile to talk about, you know, what's surprising and what might you not expect that you should expect when you become a founder.
And I think there's a lot of these types of examples where people will hear them and they say, oh, yeah, that's kind of obvious. And what's obvious to you is not necessarily obvious to everybody else. And there's certainly traps that you can fall into yourself that there's lots of other people who would say, well, that's kind of obvious to me. How did that happen to you? So I think that just kind of reiterating some of these and talking through them about what are probably the most common ones that people fall into or experience that are not necessarily things that they think about in advance is worthwhile talking about. So I guess with that said, let's kind of dive right in. And the first one that I wanted to talk about was the runway needed to get a startup going. And again, to kind of limit the discussion, we're not really talking about funded startups. It's stuff that you are either bootstrapping or self-funding, building on the weekend or on the side in addition to your day job in an effort to eventually go solo or try to establish a source of income to either be in addition to or to replace your existing income from a full-time job. So I guess the first thing to kind of talk about there is when you're leaving a full-time job to go solo, what are the sort of things that you have seen and heard from people that have made the decision to leave their full-time job and go solo? Like, are there mistakes that people make or assumptions that they make that later on they find that are just completely invalid?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest mistake is just underestimating the amount of time it takes to actually work on a startup. I've never had been in a situation where I've had a full-time job and I've had to run a startup on the side, but I've heard from a lot of people who have, and it's extremely difficult to do because, number one, you're probably going to be somewhat mentally exhausted after a full day of work, and building something on nights and weekends is going to take a toll on you. And I think it really comes down to being ruthless at prioritization. Ultimately, you're not going to have time to do everything that you want to do. Your task list is going to be growing faster than you can get really things accomplished. And so it comes down to being able to prioritize and then putting the most important things first and actually being able to recognize what's the most important and what might seem important, but you can actually get away with not doing. There's a lot of cool stories as well on Indie Hackers of people who have found creative ways to kind of get around this challenge. For example, Mike Parham of Sidekick. It's an open source plugin for developers to basically allow their servers to run tasks in the background. He was able to convince his employer to allow him to work on his project at work. And the reason was that he was basically the CTO of his company. He was in charge of all of their technology decisions. And so he built Sidekick on the side at home and then used it as his only customer on the job. And in this way, he was able to discover bugs and actually contribute to it because it was open source while at work and kind of cheat the system and figure out a way to actually get more hours into his project while he was working a full-time job. And I've seen other people do similar things as well. So I think the expectation that, you know, you will be able to just go to work and come home and essentially put in, you know, non-distracted, 100% productive hours over a long period of time is probably not true for a lot of people. And if you can find a clever way to allow yourself to, you know, work more hours on your project or to work it into what you're normally doing, then that's advantageous.
I really like the phrase you just used where you said cheat the system, but I also, for anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, I don't want them to think that, you know, he was going behind his employer's back or anything, because he worked with them to figure out a solution. And I think that's the key takeaway from that is finding creative ways to solve the problem that you have, which is not having the time, or you come home from work and you just don't have the energy left to do it. And I've heard of people who said, well, I'm going to get up at 5 a.m. and work on my product for 2 hours before I have to go to work. And that's their solution to it. There's other solutions like working one weekend day a week and just work from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. or something like that. I mean, there's lots of ways you can squeeze more hours out of the day, but I think it's really about identifying those places where you can kind of leverage creative solutions to the problems that you have.
Exactly. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit about this later, but depending on your situation and how much free time you actually have to devote to your project, you should probably decide what you want to work on based on that. And what I mean is, if you have a full-time job and if you have a family and if you have all sorts of responsibilities that give you a limited amount of time to work on your project, you probably shouldn't pick the most ambitious project, right? If you're going to work on a SaaS application that's going to require 6 months to develop and build, then, you know, that's something that's better suited to someone who has more time. And there's an entire spectrum of projects that you can work on and services and products that you can build that might take anywhere from, you know, Indie Hackers itself, being a content site, didn't take that much time for me to actually get out the door, even though I was working on it full time, versus something like Blue Tick, which you're working on, which I can only assume is a completely full time job.
Yeah, it's way more than a full-time job, to be honest. I don't want to, like, even go back into my rescue time account every month and look at how many hours I've spent, but it's a lot. But that's because it's a SaaS product, and I also recognized, like, going into it, it was going to take a long time. But if you don't have the time to be able to put into it, and you're trying to go from ground zero all the way to SaaS, which is kind of the holy grail, it's very difficult to make that transition if you're not doing, like, a stair-step approach, which is what Rob has kind of talked about quite quite a few times on this podcast and various talks that he's done. But you have to be able to leverage your way into either larger projects or more lucrative products that you can put out there by using the assets that you created in advance. And it's like going to the gym. You can't just go to the gym and on day one put in a 3-hour workout. You're not going to be able to sustain that. You're probably going to hurt yourself the very first day. It's just similar with starting a business. You're probably going to do things that are going to essentially kill the business before it even really gets started.
Yep, I think that's exactly what happens. And it's difficult not to do that when it's your first time, because you're looking around and all the examples that you see are these 300-pound guys at the gym who are established and can lift a lot of weight, or you know, these established companies that are building extremely ambitious products. And you might think, well, that's what everybody does, I should do the same. But it's not necessarily the case.
I think another thing that people underestimate when they're trying to figure out what sort of runway they need or how to really get started is they don't have a good sense of what the expected growth trajectory is for the business. When you're starting out, if you haven't started a bunch of businesses or tried to launch a bunch of things, it's very difficult to make comparisons between what you're doing now versus what you've done in the past to give yourself a basis for comparison that tells you whether or not you're doing well in relation to previous things you've done, or whether you're getting the traction you need to move forward. Like, what sorts of things have you seen that people can use as benchmarks to kind of help them establish that sort of thing? Like, if somebody doesn't have previous things that they've worked on, what can they use as a basis for comparison to determine how well they're doing with their startup?
Yeah, that's a tricky thing as well. And I think it leads into one of the next things we want to talk about, which is the psychological aspect of being a founder. But in reality, being a founder is very unique. And if you've worked at a company before and you've had a job where you fill a very specific role, it's almost completely different than being a founder, where you're going to have to wear every single hat. And the metrics that matter are less, you know, can you fill this one specific role? But it's, are people using your product? Are people signing up? Are you finding users? Are you increasing your revenue? And that requires you to, like I said, wear a whole bunch of different hats and do a bunch of different things. And so I think it's difficult to compare to anything that you might have done before if it's your first startup. And as a result, when there aren't, you know, these clear-cut comparisons that you can look at, you start to compare yourself to other people. You start to hit on this kind of emotional startup roller coaster type thing where you use your emotions to tell you how you're doing, right? You get a good email from a customer and you think, oh, things are going great, I'm going to succeed, right? Or you get a scathing email from a customer who says they've run into a bug and you think, oh, my startup is doomed. So I think people tend to underestimate the degree to which you fall back to that sort of short-sighted, short-term thinking to evaluate your overall progress. And, you know, I'm not sure what the exact solution is. It's different for everybody. But I know that being able to talk to people and being able to zoom out and look at the bigger picture and have some sort of a plan can really help you with your ability to evaluate whether or not what you're doing is going well.
And I think that just having some sort of guidance or advice from people that are not in your own head, they're able to look at what you're doing or experiencing a little bit more objectively, is extremely helpful. And whether that's people in a mastermind group or just other entrepreneurs that you talk to online, or even professional therapy, for example. I mean, I've been hearing more and more over the past several years, people, especially entrepreneurs, going to a professional therapist and talking to them about not just their life, but also like about their business and how things are going, and different techniques that they can use to help get off of the emotional roller coaster, where not only is the way that they feel about their life very heavily influenced by how their business is doing, but also the things that they do are driven by some of those emotions. So, for example, if you're not getting a lot of traction with your software, I see a lot of people making the mistake of trying to feature their way out of it, and they're building more and more things, but none of those things actually get them more customers. And it's because they do it because it makes them feel better. But it's kind of masking the problem, which is I don't have any customers and I'm not getting in front of people. But adding another feature or making something work better is not going to fix that.
I like what you said about seeing a therapist too, which is such an unconventional way of approaching it that most people might not think about. But as I've mentioned on my podcast, my girlfriend is a sex and relationship coach, and we also see a therapist for our relationship. And every now and then I'll talk to him about indie hackers and about how it's affecting my life, how much time I spend on it, et cetera. And it's good to be able to talk to somebody who's willing to sit down and see the problem that you're going through and understand how sort of all the different parts of your life might come together in ways that you don't expect. Like you said, the things you do in your personal life can affect the decisions that you make in your business, and the ways that you feel might affect the decisions that you make in your business as well. And also being able to talk to other founders, I think, is crucial. A lot of people aren't in the situation where they have a co-founder. And what I hear from a lot of people who aren't in a startup hub like San Francisco or New York, for example, is that it's difficult to find people who might understand what it is that you're going through, because starting a startup is such an unconventional life decision to begin with.
I think the other thing that kind of factors into the professional therapy side of it is the fact that when you're talking to a therapist, it's more of like a no judgment zone. Like if you're talking to other entrepreneurs, there's a lot of times in the back of your mind, there's always this, oh, how am I doing in relation to them? Or I don't want to look like an idiot, versus when you're talking to a therapist, like you're paying them to help you and help you understand how to move forward and solve problems. It's not about them judging you or saying, oh, you should do this or you should do that. It's more about helping you understand what's going on, how does that make you feel, and what you can do to change it if it's not in line with what you want or what you expect.
Exactly. And I think it's so underestimated, like how much of a role basically imposter syndrome plays in being a founder and always thinking that other people are a step ahead of you. And in reality, it's easy to feel that way, because if you look at other entrepreneurs and you look around at people who are writing blog posts and doing podcasts and giving advice, it's trivially easy to find somebody who has more experience than you or more knowledge than you, or who's progressed further than you have, just because people in those positions are more likely to have their messages amplified in the first place. But that still takes a psychological toll on you. So for sure, being able to talk to somebody in a judgment-free zone where they're really not someone who's going to judge you for what you've done, or really even somebody you can compare yourself to because they themselves aren't an entrepreneur, can be very helpful. I think also practicing as an entrepreneur, being able to be vulnerable and open with other people about what's going on. The easiest thing in the world is when somebody asks you what's going on with your company to say, it's all going great, even if everything is on fire. If you take the time to really slow down and let people know, let people end to what's going on with you, I think you'll have much more fulfilling and enjoyable conversations, and it'll be easier for you to find people who can identify with you because you're letting them into the hardships that you're going through. And what entrepreneur doesn't have hardships that they're going through? Nobody.
One of the things that I found over the years is that, like, I have a home office, so it's extremely isolating. If I go out and check the mail and I actually walk outside, you know, more than once on any given day, there's certain periods of the year, like especially winter, because I live in New England, but there are entire weeks where I will step outside like once, maybe twice, to go check the mail or something like that. And that's about it. You know, if it snows, of course, I got to go out and, you know, snowblow the driveway. But, you know, kind of what's your experience been? Because you said that you just started working for Stripe. So like before that, you'd worked for yourself. You know, like how did you deal with that early on? Was that something that you recognized early on you needed help with and you needed to like a support group and people to talk to? Or was it something that just kind of you had this epiphany one day?
I think what's been really big for me is transparency. I've done startups before Indie Hackers, and I'd always had a co-founder, so that had made things a little bit easier for me. And I'm sort of an introvert. It's very easy for me to sit at home working at my desk and like you said, never leave. But with a co-founder, that was a little bit easier because at least he was there too, and I could, you know, go in the other room and talk to somebody. With Indie Hackers, I basically started it by myself, which meant that there was no one I could talk to in my immediate vicinity. There's no one, you know, in my house who I could talk to about what I was doing. But being transparent online, basically vomiting out every fact and detail about what I was working on, whether it was through blog posts or Twitter or my email newsletter, I found really helped me, I guess, feel less alone and a little bit less contained. Even being at Stripe, I still work from home most of the time. I'm a 20-minute walk from the Stripe office, which is hundreds of people in it, but I work from home almost every day. I haven't been into the office a single time in the last week. And I think really having an online community of people who are going through similar things or people who care has been helpful for me in that regard.
What you just said about transparency is actually, I'd say, a little bit counterintuitive, something that I kind of discovered. And I think I knew this all along, but about a month or two ago, I did this 21-day series of video blog posts before my launch. And every evening I'd sit down with a glass of whiskey and I'd record a video and then put it out to my mailing list for 3 weeks straight. And I was actually very, very surprised about the email feedback that I got. There were a bunch of comments and stuff on the blog itself, but I got a lot of emails from people that were encouraging and helpful and, hey, have you thought about this? Or, you know, you just mentioned this problem. Have you thought about doing this other thing over there? And it's interesting to see how helpful people are when they're like, if you become transparent about the stuff that you're doing. And I don't think it's obvious to most people that the benefits of doing that actually outweigh the risks of like putting yourself out there and being judged.
Oh, I agree completely. And I think this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, that unless you've started a company, you've had kind of the consumer lens on your entire life. And what do you see as a consumer? You see companies being this, it's kind of big corporate walls that always say we, and they never really reveal like how the sausage is made, and it's all very like neat and packaged, you know, and so it's easy to imitate that. But in reality, if you let your guard down and you talk about what you're doing, you're talking about what's hard for you and the decisions that you're trying to make, It's just something about that that people really connect with. In my early newsletters for Indie Hackers, I've kind of gotten away from this recently, but every newsletter was basically, hey, here's what I'm doing with Indie Hackers. Here's what I did this week. Here's what I'm worried about. Here's what I'm thinking about from the future. And I would also get a ton of email replies from people who were going through similar things or people who wanted to help. And just, you know, not only is the process of hearing from people extremely motivating and helpful, but just writing it down, writing down what's hard and telling somebody also felt great. So I think it can't be underestimated. And the advantages of being transparent. I mean, no, people aren't really going to steal your business model and steal everything that you're doing because you're sharing your details. And the people who do that are oftentimes not the most competent of people.
It's funny you say that because I've never seen anybody rip off somebody else's idea and actually make it successful.
No, it's just not. Like, if someone who's really like a go-getter and who's really talented is probably not going to be sitting around waiting for somebody to reveal their transparent, you know, details of their business so they can copy them step by step. So those are the people you have to worry about. And I think the common fears of being transparent are mostly unfounded.
So I guess the next thing to kind of dive into is what sort of resources do you need to get started? When you started Indie Hackers, you said that it was really just you kind of building this on your own. Was it more work than you expected, less work? You said you got it to around $5,000 a month in recurring revenue just from advertising. But like, how much effort kind of went into that before you got to that point?
A lot of effort went into it, and it was by far more work than I expected. And I think this is the case with pretty much any startup. There's always going to be more work than you expect. And my favorite analogy for this actually came from an article I read years ago about being a programmer and estimating how much time it takes to get something programmed. So the analogy they used was a map. If you look at, you know, a map and you want to chart a course between two different points, you might just draw a straight line and you might draw a slightly curvy line to avoid some mountains or something. But when you actually zoom in close on that map and you look at that line, it actually becomes much squigglier because you realize that you have to work your way around all sorts of bends and trees and hills and rivers. I think the same is true of being a programmer and the same is true of being a startup founder. From the outset, you might think, okay, I need to hit these giant milestones. But when you actually get into the weeds and start working on it, you end up having to deal with a whole bunch of unexpected things you just couldn't see when you were zoomed out. And so it becomes a whole bunch more work than you planned. With Indie Hackers specifically, the bulk of the work, at least initially, was just doing the interviews and trying to figure out a repeatable, scalable process for doing 3 to 5 interviews per week while also building up a website and trying to charge for ads. And that process took months and months and months. I mean, I was working on Indie Hackers for 3 or 4 months before I even really started focusing on ads. And I've seen similar patterns with other people. So to the degree that you can prioritize and cut features out of your product that are unnecessary and do only the bare minimum that you need, you should do that for sure, because even that will take you longer than you expect.
Now, I guess if we dig a little bit more into that, like, why is it that these things take longer than we expect? And one of the things that I've kind of come across is that I'll say my expectations for the quality of my own work tend to be high. And I don't think that, you know, people listening to this are probably too dissimilar from that. But we have these expectations for things that we're going to put out in the world. And because we don't want to be negatively judged for putting out a product that is subpar, like, we spend a lot of extra time doing things that are probably not necessary. So whether it's a graphic design polish or making sure that all the different edge cases are taken care of, but like, we'll spend a lot more time on things than we probably should, and in an effort to not look bad. And the reality is, like, you can get away with a lot, especially if people are not necessarily paying you for that particular feature or for that particular piece of your product. I mean, people are willing to tolerate a lot of different things.
Yeah, and I think that's something I personally underestimated before I started doing startups, is how much that I would care what people thought. If somebody says something negative about something that I've built, it feels like a dagger through the heart. And just trying to avoid that feeling has led me to spend hours working on things that, like you said, might not be the most crucial for my business's success. And maybe I can actually let them, you know, those things fall by the wayside. But definitely I have perfectionist tendencies that have forced me to some degree to spend time on things that I didn't need to spend time on. And I think this affects a lot of people. A good example recently was, I had a friend who told me that I recently redesigned my newsletter, and she said, oh, your new newsletter looks so great. The old one looked kind of crappy. And it's funny because I took that as a compliment, because I knew the old one looked crappy, at least by my own design standards. And I had been able to successfully fight off the urge to redesign it for as long as I did. That was progress for me.
Are there ways that you found to like kind of protect your, and I don't want to say fragile ego, but like, I mean, I think all of us have a fragile ego to some extent where like, you know, you can get 10 emails that say, hey, you're doing a great job. And you get one that says, oh, this sucked. And that one outweighs the other 10. Are there things that you've found that kind of protect yourself from those types of things? I mean, I've run into that myself where like, and I'm not saying those are the exact numbers, but like the negative stuff weighs on you substantially more than the positive stuff.
It really does. And I think that's just a part of being human. I mean, for me, it's not even negative emails. It's Hacker News. That's the worst for me because I put a lot of content on Hacker News, which for those of you who don't know, is a community site for developers. And people there are trolls very often. And they'll say lots of negative things without, they'll leave drive-by negative comments without really even thinking. And it hurts. The thing that helps me the most is just getting people on my side. Nowadays, I work with my brother who Stripe also hired to help me with Indie Hackers. And when we see negative comments, we'll both basically talk about them and talk about, you know, whether they have any merit and kind of reassure each other. I think that's extremely helpful. When you're sitting in a vacuum and there's nobody on your side, there's nobody that you can talk to who can take your side and say, hey, you're right, or this person's wrong, or don't listen to them. And I think it weighs on you a lot more.
Yeah, and then the thing that you just said about being able to talk to your brother about some of the stuff that comes in, there's a big difference between something that is simply a troll comment where it is much more of a personal attack versus a legitimate criticism of a piece of your work that isn't right for somebody based on their situation or, you know, it's broken. There's a very big difference between those two things. And sometimes that line is very much blurred and it weighs on us regardless.
Yeah, it really does. And I'm the type of person that almost no matter what kind of negative feedback I get from a stranger on the internet, it's going to weigh on me, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate, whether it's in private or other people can see it. I'm going to think about it for a while. And like you said, it's going to stand out more in my mind than 10 positive comments. And so I think it's, you know, it's something that as a founder, you need to be prepared for. I don't even know if there's a great way to prepare for it other than to just expect it and know it's going to happen. One of the things that I told myself early on was that it's very hard to get people on the internet to care at all. Right, most things that people put out there never get any attention, never get any comments whatsoever. And so if people are giving you negative comments, then at least they care to some degree.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, the fact that everything takes more time than you expect it to. But I think there's also kind of a corollary there. And this kind of especially applies to marketing endeavors or development. But I think there's this false equivalent of time being the same as money when you're trying to put your marketing efforts out there. Like everything that you do that is marketing related is going to cost you money or a lot of money that you may not necessarily have. And you don't want to risk that if it's not going to work. So people tend to do these like little experiments that are not really statistically relevant, but at the same time they do them because that's kind of the budget that they're comfortable spending. But I think the kind of general point that I'm trying to make there is that when people do that, they have this idea in their head that, oh, I want to do, for example, an infographic and to hire a designer, it's going to cost me $1,000 to have that done. And it's too much money. So I'm just not going to do it versus doing it themselves and not spending the money to do it. But yes, it's not going to look as good. But at the same time, it still gets done and it can achieve the goals as long as they kind of put a marketing slant on it. It's really about being creative in your marketing efforts in a way that doesn't break your bank.
And what do you think is the biggest like misconception there in terms of what people expect versus what actually happens?
Well, I think there's two sides of that. I think that there's your own expectation for what it should be or should look like versus what people on the receiving end are going to think or look at and evaluate it. So like when you're doing a new marketing campaign, for example, you want to make it as top notch as possible because you want to get the most impact. You want to get the most conversions, highest number of click-throughs and all that stuff. So of course your thought is, hey, I need to do a fantastic job on this. But the reality is like on the other side, people don't evaluate those types of things for more than a few seconds unless they get to the point where they're actually going to click through and maybe read like an article that you wrote. But like with paid ads, for example, like there's a headline, like that's the most important thing on the whole ad. And if you don't nail the headline, everything else doesn't matter at all. I've seen advertisements. I think I mentioned this to Rob once. I saw an advertisement on Facebook that it was a snake, and it wasn't even like a real snake. It was just like this weird thing that showed up in my Facebook feed, and it caught my eye. And I don't know how much he was paying for it, but the fact that it caught my eye was enough to make me notice it and look over at it and say, "Huh, I wonder what that is." And then I saw that it said drip on it. And it really, really, like, that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to catch people's attention. And if you get the right people to look at it, then they'll come through and they'll click through and take a look at the other stuff and look at the quality of what you've got, like whether it's the writing or the marketing collateral that goes with it. But just catching their attention is really the main goal, not like having the best design thing. Like, you don't need to spend as much money as Buffer does on like an infographic, for example. And that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, is like, you can probably get away with a lot less than you think you need.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think even more broadly, that reminds me of this thing I've been harping on a lot in the last few weeks, just by talking to people on the Indie Hackers Forum about their landing pages and about their product ideas, how important it is to realize that what you see as a founder and how you look at what you're putting out is not the same as other people see it. It's not the same viewpoint that your customers have. It's not the same viewpoint that your partners might have. And being able to step outside of yourself and look at things from their perspective is, you know, might be the number one quality that you need to have as a founder. I've underestimated this to a huge degree, and especially early on in my career, I spent a lot of time doing things based on my intuition. You know, whatever I felt was important had to be what everybody else felt was important. And so I would work on that, and then I would realize that nobody cared what I thought was important, right? I wasn't solving the problem that they wanted. And so this, I think the example that you just gave is a really good one. You know, if you're crafting an ad, or if you're designing your newsletter, or if you're planning out your marketing campaigns, it's very important to look at what it is that your customers or that your visitors are going to care about and try to prioritize those things first rather than prioritizing the things that you might intuitively feel are okay as a creator. And I think this is probably true in almost any sort of creative endeavor. My brother's a writer, you know, and one of the hardest things for any writer to do is to be able to step outside of themselves and look at their story and their writing from the reader's perspective. You know, sometimes it takes a few weeks of not writing and stepping back and looking at what you've written later on with fresh eyes. And I think the same thing can be true as a founder. Whether you're talking about coming up with an idea, you know, is this an idea that customers actually want? Is this something that solves a problem that's valuable to them? Or is this, you know, a feature that you really wanted to add because you thought it was cool?
I mean, features is another one that, you know, we spend a lot of time building certain features that some customers just don't even care about. And I've done this myself, but I've also talked to people. I think I answered an email this morning where somebody was talking about how they just wanted to implement this one more feature before they launch. And the reality is, like, that's a snowball where you can always look to say, oh, I'm going to do this other feature or do this other feature. And you're always kind of delaying that launch in order to delay judgment on all the work and effort that you've put into it. And if you delay it long enough, then you never get judged. So you're really putting yourself in this position where you're never going to win because the game never starts, I guess.
Yeah, it's totally true. And it's subtle. I mean, you might not be conscious of the fact that you're doing it to make yourself feel better and to avoid judgment. You might just think that it's easy to convince yourself that you really do need this particular feature. And once that's built out, you really do need this other feature. And I think this is something that, you know, generally, I think if you're starting a business, it's advantageous if you have some development skills and you can code what you're working on yourself rather than having to hire out. But it's also a trap that developers fall into more so than other people, specifically because if you have that ability to do something, if you're really good at writing code, then it feels good to write code. And it's easy for that to be the answer to everything, when in reality, there's all these other hats that you need to wear and you need to actually get your product out the door to succeed. So features is a really big trap that a lot of first-time founders fall into, just taking too long to launch. You know, there are other traps there too as well. I think, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I see founders fail and why founders tell me that they ended up failing is because they quit early. They essentially hadn't really put in the time that they needed to solve the particular problems that were preventing their businesses from succeeding. And that, you know, often comes down to a psychological issue of, okay, well, they didn't have enough wins under their belt. They were feeling demoralized about their project. It was this long death march of building features and never really getting any traffic and, you know, trying random marketing efforts and never really having any success. That gets amplified 100-fold if you take 6 months to build a product because you're continually adding features. Whereas if you build something like, good example would be Josh Pigford of Bear Metrics, who got his first product out the door and his first customer in something like 8 days, 9 days, he didn't have time to get demoralized and quit. So not only is it helpful to build things quickly in order to talk to customers and actually succeed, but it's helpful for your own morale.
Well, I think putting something in front of them faster allows you to get the feedback to kind of course correct when you start to go in the wrong direction. Because as you said earlier, there's a difference between how you perceive things versus how your customers perceive things. And it's very easy to confuse the two and think that you know what they need. And then when you put it in front of them, they point out all these flaws that you didn't think of or consider that make you have to go in a different direction. And by delaying, put it in front of them, you're just delaying the results of getting that feedback so that then you have to make the course correction. So it's 3 months down the road instead of, you know, 3 weeks.
I think a lot of it comes down to the curse of knowledge, where this really affects creators in any industry, not just founders. But ultimately, if you spend a lot of time working on something, you end up building all sorts of mental models that describe how it works. You'll understand all of your features better than your customers do. You'll understand all of your copy better than your customers do. And it can be difficult to sort of tease apart what you understand, but it's not clear to your customers, versus things that are clear to your customers. And so it kind of gets in the way of you being able to be as effective as you would like, because you're sitting here thinking, oh, it all makes so much sense. And your customers are like, I don't get it. You show your landing page to a friend and they say, you know, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do here. So I think talking to people and kind of getting out of this kind of solo, solitary lifestyle where you're just working by yourself without talking to anybody is extremely helpful. And it's hard to break out of that, because as a founder, you're essentially responsible for everything. It's the kind of the default is that you don't talk to anybody and you're constantly handling this avalanche of work.
I wonder if there's kind of a predisposition for software developers to have that mode of operation, just because I almost feel like in order to be a software developer, it almost feels like you have to have like introverted tendencies, because you sit in front of a computer all day, you don't talk to people, and people who are introverted would be more drawn to that line of work because they don't have to talk to somebody. But it hurts you when you're trying to like build a business. And if your goal is to have this lifestyle where you sit in front of a computer all day and you don't talk to anybody, and like that's the ideal life for you, and that's what you're working towards, it makes it difficult when you get put yourself in a position where in order to be successful, you have to talk to people. So, I mean, I think that kind of leads us into like the lifestyle of being an entrepreneur, and what is it really like versus what you thought it was going to be like when you first started.
What you just said reminds me a lot of how I decided to start Indie Hackers, because I had 3 or 4 other ideas that I was strongly considering. And I knew from my history, I said, okay, Cortland, you're a developer. In the past, you've always tended to spend way more time coding and getting the product out the door. And you found every excuse under the sun to delay marketing. And so I picked Indie Hackers as an idea because I knew that the product itself was simple. It's just a blog, right? The actual work that would go into it would require me to do the marketing and require me to talk to people. And so I think that's kind of a hack that you can use if you're aware that maybe you're a little bit more introverted and that you're a little bit, you know, you have a tendency to put off stuff that you're not good at or that you don't like marketing. Pick an idea where the product itself is easy relative to the marketing part of it. And so you very quickly run into a wall where the only thing that's left is the marketing.
That's really just playing to your own personal strengths, but you can't, I don't think that it's going to be possible in most cases to build a business where you never talk to anybody. You're going to have to get out and talk to somebody at some point, because like a customer is going to have a question, or you're going to have to get feedback on what it is that somebody really needs versus what you thought that they needed. Because otherwise you're in this position where you've put something out there, and as you said, like the world doesn't care. You post something on the internet and nobody cares. Like that's the worst thing for like a product launch or anything that you put out there, is that you post it and you get zero traffic and nobody bats an eye because they didn't even know about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's unfortunately what happens to, I think, probably the majority of startups. And it's important to be aware that even if you have a successful launch and things do go really well and people do know about it, that's not the end of the story. And it never is the end of the story. And I think it's an expectation that a lot of people have that, you know, I just launched, got a lot of traffic, and word of mouth took over from there. That almost never happens. And reality happens is that you're still on the hook for figuring out a sustainable growth strategy and a marketing strategy. And that job pretty much never ends, because at every single stage of your business, the techniques that work change and you have to figure out a new way to get your product into more customers' hands. So I think it's important to be aware of that. And in many ways, just being aware of the fact that it's never really over, and that no matter what level of success you achieve, it's always going to be more work to hit the next level, will help prevent you from becoming demoralized when things don't go that well.
Do you think there's a danger in that, where you're going to be in a situation where you don't have all the answers because you don't have all the data for a particular problem? And kind of going back to your example with Indie Hackers, you said that you'd spent a couple of months on it, 3 to 6 months before you even started working on the advertising side. So you were working on it. Like, did you know in advance that, oh, this is going to be an advertising model and that's where the revenue was going to come from? Or was that you kind of had that as an idea, but you hadn't really thought it out or fleshed it out or had customers kind of waiting in the wings when you got the product itself done? Because I wonder how prevalent that problem is, where people delay those types of problems things or spend too much time on them. You know, there's the opposite of that is they just delay doing anything before they have solved all the problems, and then they never get anything done.
Yeah, I think my particular situation was that I was basically doing that. I mean, the problem that I really wanted to solve with Indie Hackers was traffic. I wanted a repeatable way to get people in the door reading articles, and I didn't feel comfortable moving on toward revenue and finding advertisers to work with until I was confident that I was going to be able to bring more people in. And then at a certain point, I said, you know what? The traffic is high enough. I should start making money. And I hadn't solved that problem, and I just got to it. You know, in hindsight, I really could have started focusing on generating revenue, and I probably should have from day one. There was nothing stopping me from doing it back then. I wouldn't say I was spinning my wheels, but I was definitely working on something that should have been less of a priority. I really should have focused on revenue more. And I think, you know, a lot of startups come down to prioritization. You really get a lot less done. Well, I won't say that you get less done than you think you will, but really working on a startup is more work than it appears from the outset. And every task that you work on will probably give you the idea for 3 or 4 more things to work on, 3 or 4 more bugs to fix, additional features to add. And so your to-do list generally grows faster than you're working on it. So what it really comes down to is prioritization. You know, how do you know what's the most important thing to work on, and how do you know what you can toss out?
Yeah, I think there's people like I have some perfectionist tendencies sometimes, but the one thing that I've realized is that, you know, in my younger years, kind of date myself there, but in my younger years, I would look at what a business was working on. And an example that jumps into my head was Oracle's installer was absolutely awful. Like, it never worked the first time I ran it. And it was like that for easily 10 years. It never worked. I always had to go in and mess around with stuff and get it to work. And the installer would always fail. I'm like, how is Oracle successful when their installer doesn't even work? And of course, it just made me angry, you know? And I look back on it now and it's like, well, once they're past that initial hurdle, the installer doesn't matter. So to solve that, you know, oh, just hire these professional consulting services to come in and they'll install it for you. And it's just like, oh, well, yeah, that's not only does it put money in their pocket, but it also gets around the problem. So they don't have to fix the problem. And it's just, it's interesting to see those types of decisions that in retrospect, like, that totally makes sense. But at the time it was infuriating. And I think there's a lot of places where that prioritization, there's creative problem solving that you can do inside the business to get around or avoid solving problems that aren't really that important to solve for you. You want to have everything perfect, but the reality is you just can't. You don't have time because, as you said, your to-do list is going to expand much faster than your ability to get everything done.
Yeah, and just getting comfortable with that state of affairs, I think, is extremely important as a founder. Just knowing and accepting that you're not going to get everything done is something that you're better served if you're aware of that up front. And I also, to your point with the Oracle example, I think probably the most common source of bad ideas is people looking at a product that's successful, finding some, you know, highly visible flaw with that product and saying, oh, I'm going to make the UI look a little bit nicer, or I'm going to make, you know, this part be a little bit better designed, and I'll do a much better job than Oracle does. And not really realizing that the reason why that they've slacked on that part of their product is because it's not actually as important as it might seem. And so, you know, as an outsider looking in, it might be difficult to determine what's important. But a lot of times you see successful companies that are doing well, but, you know, are ostensibly kind of crappy looking. It's because they know something that you don't about what's important and what actually drives your business and what's not. They're just prioritizing. So let me ask you, what do you think about work-life balance, Mike?
I think work-life balance, if you have a home office, is extremely hard because if you're at your computer, like if your computer is in your living room, for example, it can be very difficult to draw lines between when you're working and when you're not. And it just makes things a lot harder than it probably would be otherwise. So drawing those distinctions, like especially if you're a solo founder, you don't have a co-founder or anything like that, it's just a hard problem to solve. I don't know as I have any great recommendations for that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, what about you? Like, I think you said that you have a home office. Like, how do you establish any like boundaries between work and, I guess, the non-work time?
I, for one, am terrible at establishing those kind of boundaries. I'm somewhat of a workaholic, but I'm getting better at it. And I think the key is to realize that as a founder, you're always going to have distractions. Like we've talked about a number of times, your to-do list is always going to be infinite, and you're always going to have more things that you can get done. And you're probably also going to be getting a lot of email, which is extremely interruptive, and it can sometimes be urgent. And so you're going to have to deal with that stuff at times where it might be inconvenient. And it's you don't have a boss you can just say, look, I'm not going to work at these points in times. You're your own boss, and it's up to you to determine your schedule. And I've talked to people who are varying degrees of success with doing this. So, for example, I talked to Wes Boss a couple weeks ago, And he basically works a 9-to-5, 9-to-6 schedule, leaves his laptop upstairs, and refuses to bring it downstairs when it's time to hang out with his family. That works for some people, and I think, you know, if you have the kind of discipline to set a schedule like that, it can be extremely productive, because being always on and always working means that you're likely to be pretty inefficient. So I don't know if there's a secret, you know, technique or magic bullet for solving that, but it's important to be aware that your work will never feel like it's done, and that it's not like a normal job where, you know, 5 o'clock comes around and you're done on your own. You need to really have the discipline to make rules like that for yourself and figure out what works for you and your business.
I think that kind of goes back to the prioritization of the tasks on your task list as well. It's like, what is it that is important to you? And I think there's a wide range of opinions on this. DHH from Basecamp has constantly railed about like the working hours of Silicon Valley and how people should, you know, come to work and they're paid to be there for 40 hours a week. So don't make them work 60 or 80. And the fact that you're working longer hours is not necessarily a badge of honor. But I think there's the flip side of it where there are some people, like if they are a workaholic and they enjoy the work that they're doing, then working 50, 60, 80 hours a week, like that's fun to them, you know? So I think that there's this broad spectrum that people fall into, and there's no right or wrong answers. It's what is right or wrong for you, not for everyone. Cause I don't think that there's a general case answer that you can apply to everyone. It's, you know, there's a wide range of answers, and some apply to some people and some apply to others. And I don't think it's wise to say that like, this is the way that it should be done for everyone just because it works for you.
Yeah. And I think it's also worth experimenting, because sometimes you don't know what really works for you unless you've tried a bunch of different things. I, for example, thought I really like the idea of being a remote worker and going to different places and working from the beach or from the coffee shop or from a friend's apartment. And I tried that earlier on in my startup career, and it just did not work for me. I was very unproductive. I spent a lot of time doing all sorts of side things besides actually getting into the groove that I like to fall into. And it turns out that what works for me the best is to just sit at home. And it's kind of boring, but I get by far the most work done. And so I think I wouldn't have really realized that unless I attempted to experiment. I think it's worth trying out different things.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. Like, I cannot take a laptop and go to a coffee shop and sit there for a little while. And I know that it works for some people, but it absolutely does not work for me at all. Like, I just can't get work done. It doesn't work for me. But as you said, you won't know until you try it.
Yeah, exactly. And something that's been surprising for me also to add to that list is, you know, even though I rarely go into the office to work at Stripe, when I do, I have very productive days. And I think a lot of it just comes down to everybody can see what's on my monitor. So I can't exactly do a bunch of random stuff and watch YouTube videos, whereas at home, those distractions are my own private distractions. So again, definitely worth experimenting and seeing what works for you.
Well, we're kind of running short on time here, but I did want to touch on kind of one last topic here. And that was about, like, what are the expected success levels or income levels after various time frames? And I think this is a case where kind of goes back to what people's expectations are about either the runway that they need or the resources that they need or the time that they need to build a product and make it successful. You've interviewed like dozens of people so far for Indie Hackers. Like, what is kind of the range of time frames it has taken for people to start something, you know, kind of from ground zero and make it successful to the point that they could go full time on it?
Yeah, this is a good question, because it's difficult to answer, because it turns out that when people started their business, it's actually a much fuzzier line than you might think looking from the outside in. So sometimes it's very clear cut. You know, they started their business on August 11th and launched it, and then it was successful in, you know, 2 years. But oftentimes people's businesses succeed depending on, you know, based on things that they did well before they started their business. So one thing that, you know, I get a lot of feedback on is someone will have a company and they'll start it and get a lot of customers, and people will say, well, you know, that guy cheated. You know, he already had an audience beforehand, or he already, you know, built a list beforehand and used that to bootstrap this business. Or, you know, they already had a lot of expertise in one particular area, and that's the only reason that, you know, she was able to start this company. And in situations like that, it's hard to say, you know, when was the real start date, you know? And it's tough, because as a founder, you end up comparing yourself to other people's success. It's not always visible when they really started doing these things that were crucial to their success. So I've seen a huge, you know, variety of levels. And the other thing that's worth talking about with startups is that they kind of follow a power law distribution where, you know, a very small percentage of startups will grow way faster and way bigger than others. And you'll always have those people thrust into the limelight where it's very easy to compare yourself to them. But in reality, there's such a huge range that you shouldn't compare yourself only to the top people. And you should be aware that, you know, if it takes you 2 years to grow your business to the point where it can sustain your lifestyle, that's perfectly fine and it's not at all abnormal. If it takes you 3 years, that's also perfectly fine and not at all abnormal. So I would caution people to not expect or hope that they're going to find some sort of overnight success. It's probably not going to happen in a couple months or 6 months or even a year.
Yeah, that reminds me of a talk that Harry Hollander from MoreAware Software gave. It was an attendee talk at MicroConf a few years ago. And he said that if he had calculated back to when he started the business to that point, which was, I think, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 years or something like that, he had just gotten to the point where he would make the same amount of money as he stayed at his previous job. And it's interesting to see that because it does kind of illustrate the point that, it takes longer than you think it will, but there's all these other things that, you know, factor into it that you didn't expect when you got started.
Yeah, I would definitely not go into startups expecting to get rich or get rich overnight. And I think it's probably the most common reason that people go into it. But I'm in the same boat. If I had just gotten a software engineering job after college, I would be doing a lot better financially than I am now, having done startups. And that's not true of everyone. You know, some people make a lot of money doing it. But I think there are other benefits worth looking into. Personally, for me, what's really motivating is I like freedom. I like financial freedom and knowing that I'm basically the one in control of my finances. I like the locational freedom and being able to go where I want whenever I want. I like the time, being able to work on my own schedule. I like the freedom to determine basically the vision for the product that I'm building. And I think all of those things are their own reward for me. So I would also caution people not to get too sucked up into this idea that they're going to be an overnight financial success and make millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, all those things that you just touched on, they're ancillary benefits of being a founder, and you can't necessarily get them from a full-time job. Sometimes you can. Obviously, like, there's financial rewards for having a full-time income, and you don't have to pay for your own health insurance, for example, and that's fantastic. But, you know, the freedom to kind of come and go as you choose and work on things you want to and not do the things that you don't, or, you know, so long as they don't drive your business into the ground, it's okay to kind of ignore some of those things. But you have to kind of pick and choose your battles, and there are going to be times where you're going to have to do stuff that you don't want to do and you don't like to do, but it's part of business and it may not be why you signed up for it, but it's still got to get done.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I mean, a huge percentage of the things that I do are not my favorite thing. If I was only doing my favorite thing, I would just be writing code all day, every day, but that's like maybe 5 or 10% of what I do with my business and what I've done with businesses in the past. And whenever I go over that limit, it's because I'm being irresponsible and not doing the things that I actually should be doing. And that's not to say that I don't like the other parts of running the business. I think I've really begun to appreciate, you know, some of the more marketing type tasks and even some of the more extroverted, like talking to people and interviewing customers and interacting with people, I've really started to appreciate. But it's important to realize that as a founder, you're going to have to do whatever is required of you. And that's not always going to be your favorite thing. And if you prioritize only doing your favorite thing in your business, then chances are you'll be spending a lot of time on things that your business doesn't need and neglecting things that your business does.
And ultimately, I think those things will probably come back to bite you. I mean, you can't avoid the things that are going to make your business successful. You can't always do the things that you just want to do because they're not going to benefit the company and it's not going to make the numbers that you need in order to make your own payroll. So you have to buckle down sometimes.
Yeah, you really do. And I think that's another reason why it's important to choose to do something in a field that you care about and that you like. I started Indie Hackers because I like startups. I really like the idea of revenue generating startups that don't necessarily have to follow the Silicon Valley model of raising a ton of money. And I could talk to people about it all day. So no matter what, even if I'm doing mundane tasks that I don't particularly care for, at least I'm doing it in the service of something that I do care for. And that's helped me stay motivated even when the times are tough. Very easy to underestimate how easy it is to quit when things aren't going your way for 3 weeks straight or 3 months straight or 10 months straight. You know, I can't recommend enough to work on something that is actually meaningful to you and is not just kind of an opportunistic business play.
Speaking of opportunistic business plays, how can people get in touch with you? Because, you know, you said you enjoy hearing from people. So kind of wrapping things up here, where can people find out more about you or get in touch with you if they have follow-up questions?
So I'm pretty active on Twitter. I try to be at CS Allen. And obviously, I'd love to hear from you on ndhackers.com. We've got a community forum there where all sorts of entrepreneurs go to ask each other questions and get feedback. So if you create a thread on the forum, I will almost certainly see it and try to give a response. Or you can just email me, cortland@ndhackers.com.
Well, Cortland, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate you having you on the show and look forward to more episodes of Indie Hackers.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.